Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition, the latest episode, the latest chapter of Life on Planet Porky with myself, Mike Parry, and of course with the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, how are you this fine day?
Kind of hoping for snow, I think, Michael. Looking out the window a bit wistfully, yeah. You know, it just feels like it would be nice to be snowed in at the moment, as we're kind of in anyway, you know, can't go anywhere, can't do anything. So
well, I know what you mean. Snowed in. I know what you mean, and I hate being in, so I am now, I've become a devoted walker again. I let my walking sort of hobby slip a bit over the last couple of years. You know, I've become idle and lazy, but I'm now determined to walk again. So today I'll be walking across the North Downs down here in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, probably about 4 miles today. But then I cheat and get a bus back. But yeah,
that is cheating. Yeah, no, that's cheating.
No, it's not. It's a great effort.
Of course it is. Do you know, my daughter most days goes out for a 10K run.
Right.
Barely scratches the sides. I mean, she's incredible. I wouldn't be able to do it myself.
Yeah, but well, of course not. No.
I did used to be in the habit of walking about 3 miles a day around the common.
Yes. No, that's good.
About six times around the common. Yeah, but it takes time. That's the thing. It's very time consuming.
Yeah, but it's good thinking time. I find it good thinking time. And also, it has very great effect on the way you feel just by being out and getting the literally sunshine. I know there's no sunshine at the moment, but literally just getting fresh air and the rays of the sun on your face, it makes you feel better. It opens up your skin and all this kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah, we do need fresh air.
Yeah, we do. We definitely
need fresh air. And that is conducive to having immunity against the virus, of course.
It is. It's also to break the terrible monotony of lockdown. So I take with me a couple of little miniature bottles of whiskey, you see,
because it's very... Oh, well, that's what it's all about.
Well, it's very cold at the moment, and I like cold. So I reward myself by walking the 4 and 4.5 miles across the Downs to a point where I know there are a couple of benches. And then I sit on the bench and examine my phone to see what's been happening while I've been walking, and I will have a nip of whiskey to ward off the cold. And, you know, it's something that breaks up the day, which we all should be doing.
So all the calories that you've discharged doing the walking, you then suck straight back on by downing the whiskey.
Yeah, but it's so little whiskey. I mean, it's literally, it's a miniature bottle of whiskey. That's about a mouthful, you know, it's hardly anything there. And
a mouthful, than a mouthful's a waste.
Well, okay, a big mouthful then, put it that way.
Family show, come on.
Yeah, and anyway, the point is not really to get rid of calories. It's to just keep the body supple and fit and just to give you another focus on the day, because otherwise we're all going to go mad. Some of my friends are already going mad.
Yeah, you know? I know. It is a big problem, the mental health issue this time around.
It certainly is. Now, yesterday, right, I found out which category I'm in when it comes round to the vaccination, and I'm in category 5, okay?
Well, you're lucky. I have to wait ages after you.
Why? Do you know what category you're in?
I think I'm in 8.
It could well be. I'm a bit disappointed I was in 5. I said to the lady, look, hang on, you know, gentlemen of a certain age here, you know, history of, you know, underlying health problems, diabetes and all this kind of stuff, you know. But she was quite, I'm going to have some blood tests to, you know, to do with my heart and all that kind of stuff. She said, well, we'll have a chat when you come in. But you're absolutely right because, yes, you are right. Category 1, residents in care homes. Category 2, all aged 80 or over. Category 3, over 75. Category 4, over 70. And then me, category 5, all people aged 65 and over. I am just in that category. And that's me. And there's 3.4 million of us. So, you know.
Have you had a go at that app that's kicking around? My daughter sent it to me, where you can type in your details and it tells you how many millions of people are ahead of you in the queue. When you are likely to get your vaccine.
Yeah.
And I did mine, and there are between 18 and 24 million people ahead of me in the queue.
Yeah.
I'm likely to get mine between September and November this year.
You're joking. You've got to wait till September or November.
Yeah.
Golly.
Yeah.
That's very interesting because I've got here category 8, which you're in, and you're absolutely right. There's 4.3 million people in that, okay? And there's only one lower category, category 9. Which is basically for all the rest. So Yes. I want to get
none of my kids are going to get theirs until next year.
No, I wouldn't have thought so. You're absolutely right. And on that very issue, I'll be going this weekend, in fact, as of today and tomorrow and the day after, into a radio studio, okay? And I've started to worry about this because I thought, you see, the number of people infected when I first started going to the studios was 1 in 900 in London. It's now down to 1 in 30. I mean, that's starting to get a bit worrying, isn't it?
Very worrying. And I was talking to my mother last night, who lives in Kent. She lives in a cul-de-sac, a close. And she called me last night to say, you know that couple, Mr. and Mrs. X and Y, in the bungalow at the top? So I said, yes. She said they both died of COVID yesterday. Oh. That brings the total in her cul-de-sac to 4 deaths and another 9 infections. So don't try and tell me, whoever's trying to tell me, that that virus isn't in their road and it isn't spreading from house to house.
Yeah, it is. What does your mother do? Is she just staying in, lock the door?
She is in the end of the cul-de-sac, sort of down a dip. The house is at the bottom of a drive.
Yeah.
And she doesn't dare go outside the door.
No.
But she's got to have her second vaccine on Sunday morning.
Right, that's a good thing.
And I'm going to have to take her.
Yeah.
Because she can't get there otherwise. She's 85.
Yes.
And so I have to go. I can do this legally because it's caring for a vulnerable person of a certain age.
Yeah.
I have to drive to Kent, take my mother to the hospital. And I have to put myself at risk going into a hospital to enable her to have her second dose. So it is really frightening now, the thought of going into her cul-de-sac.
Yeah, and don't take your mask off any point during that day.
No. In fact,
wear two masks, honestly. Because I've said to the people who run the radio station, look, I'll be arriving in a mask and my mask stays on until I go into the actual studio itself, because you're dealing with a load of people there who are passing each other's faces inches apart, walking in and out of doors, you know, as you go in and out of control rooms and studios and all that. And I want the desks separated and I want plastic screens and all that kind of stuff. I'm not being demanding, but it really is now becoming extremely catchable, if you see what I mean.
Are you sure that you ought to be going into a studio now?
Not really, but the point is, part of the whole operation of the one of the stations I work for is it's very visual. And there was a big row this week about YouTube carrying visual pictures from radio stations. That's all been sorted out. And part of the attraction is visual. So I've agreed that that's fine, because you get, like, you know, really great responses from the videos on YouTube and Twitter and Facebook. So the answer is that you couldn't do the job without being there, you see.
Well, I'm very worried about you. I don't like the idea of this.
Well, you know, it's something I've thought about. But anyway, look, we can perhaps talk about that amongst ourselves a bit later. Just to lift the feeling about what's going on at the moment. What about that great interview with Joan Collins that Piers Morgan did, OK? A lot of revelations there about my worst ever husband, how I inspired Princess Diana, my brush with death, Warren Beatty. I love Joan Collins because I think she's such a great trooper and, you know, so pragmatic about life. But I kind of got the feeling I'd read a lot of this before. I like the Warren Beatty stuff. She said he was so active. He once wore out 5 beds in 1 year living at the Beverly Wilshire. But I thought I'd heard all this before.
We have, and I wrote most of it, I think. I've done so many interviews with Joan over the years. She has long been my role model.
Yeah.
Her and her sister Jackie, I absolutely adored.
I love Jackie, yes.
Yeah, and they were wonderful, down to earth. Well, Joan still is, obviously. She's 87, the woman.
Yeah.
Last interview I did with her, I went down to Club Saint-Consang in the south of France.
Oh, lovely.
And had lunch with her there with her husband, Percy.
Yeah.
I'm never quite sure about Percy. There are lots of rumours, of course, but we'll leave that for another day.
I think we should. I don't think we want to besmirch anybody's name. Thank you.
Well, no.
Yes.
But, I mean, she's always talked about all these men of hers. I remember boarding a flight to Nice back in 1987, and I got on the plane. I was going down to the San Remo Rock Festival, and got on the plane, sat down, and didn't realise until I looked to my right that my neighbour on the plane was Joan Collins.
Oh, right. You literally didn't realise you just sat down next to Joan Collins?
Not until I looked at her, no, because I was a bit preoccupied and I was in a rush and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, we got chatting, and she was really sweet. I think that was the first time we met, really.
Right.
Properly. And a photographer ran up the plane and started snapping her wildly in her face. Right. And she let rip. She went berserk. She got up. She shouted at this guy. She demanded that he take the film out of the camera and give it to her.
Yes.
And she really was not going to stand for this.
Yeah.
And then she said to me, are you feeling okay? You don't look very well. And I said, yeah, I do feel a bit peaky and it's nothing to worry about, really. And she said, are you pregnant? I said, I don't think so. No, I don't, no reason to suspect that I might be. Well, she said, I'm a witch about these things. I am never wrong. And it turned out that she was right. And that was my first daughter.
That was amazing. That's amazing. Yeah. Do you know the reason why? Well, you know this better than me. The reason she leapt up and demanded that film, because Jean Rook used to know her very well. You know Jean Rook, the first lady of Fleet Street, obviously years ago died. And she said that she would never appear in public without hours and hours of preparation on makeup and all that. And that's why if anybody was ever occupying, you know, the number one loo on the jumbo coming from L.A., she needed it for an hour before she landed in London because she knew that people were going to take photographs of her as she got off the plane.
Yeah, well, I mean, she looked fantastic without makeup.
Yeah.
When I went to lunch with her at Saint-Cosac, she was talking about, and I was bearing in mind, sitting 2 inches from her face.
Yes.
And studying her face, because we do, we're journalists.
Yeah.
And I could tell you for sure she hadn't had any surgery.
Yeah.
She had normal signs of aging for a woman of her age, which is, I guess that was about 9 years ago or so.
Yes.
And she said, look, no, I'm terrified of needles. I'm terrified of knives. I've never had anything like that.
Yeah.
She tried Botox. Yeah. She didn't like it because she said, I'm an actress. My face needs to have expression. It needs to move.
Yeah, sure.
And the thing about Botox is that it paralyzes your face.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? A lot of modern day people have Botox, don't they? I mean,
yeah, they do. Amanda Holden's always at it. And
yeah, talking about Amanda
Simon
Holden.
Cowell, yeah.
Amanda Holden, by the way, the last picture I saw of Amanda Holden was a picture taken from behind of her in a pair of black knickers and nothing else. And I thought it was so totally inappropriate. I mean, she's got children and all this kind of stuff.
I always think that, you know, how do these kids feel? It's a bit like, I mean, poor Kate Garraway, we feel for her, don't we, at the moment?
Terrible.
Her husband, Derek Draper, is still ill. But a while ago, a couple of years ago or so, she published a book in which she was very frank about their sex life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, come on, Kate, your kids have got to go to school tomorrow.
Yeah.
Can you imagine all the ribbing in the playground?
Yeah. But you're absolutely right. My heart goes out to Kate Garraway. I mean, we don't get regular reports now on the state of her husband's health. But how unlucky is it that you're a very well-known TV presenter and your husband has the worst case of COVID-19 in this country for somebody who's still living and possibly in the world?
I know, it's awful.
Unbelievable.
You wouldn't wish it on anybody, would you?
You wouldn't wish it on anybody at all. And I tell you what the real danger there is, that because Derek's been in a coma now and bedridden for so long, they have to work on every muscle in his body every day. Otherwise, he wouldn't be able to function at all when he eventually wakes up. You know, it's a horrifying thing. But anyway, let's talk about other things. Now, other things which also are horrifying, Ms. Jones, are did you see the incredible scenes coming out of D.C., Washington, D.C., over the last 24 hours? These people who are Trump supporters actually stormed the Capitol. They stormed up Capitol Hill and they stormed into the building, which is the equivalent of the British Parliament.
Could not believe it. We were all sitting there. I was sitting there with my three children watching this unfold on the news, horrified.
Yes.
And I said to the kids, they're going to get in there. No, they're not. Don't. You're so dramatic, Mum. Don't say such things. I said, they are going to get in there. And if I were a politician in the Capitol building right now, I would be, well, you can imagine the expression I used.
Yes.
Absolutely horrifying.
Yeah.
How were they able to storm the Capitol building in the first place? Where was the security?
The gates for
them. Why were they allowed in?
There's pictures of them opening the gates for them. The security officers opened the gates and they came in. I know that building very well because I lived in D.C. between 93 and 95. And in those days, you won't believe it. You couldn't believe it in the world we live in now. But there's a load of bars on Capitol Hill, OK, around the back. It's a district, Capitol Hill, as well as a building. And I'd go there and meet a few friends. We'd have a lot of drinks and a lot of British journalists there, you know. And then I'd walk back past the Capitol building itself. And when I'd had a few drinks, I used to love going up all the steps and right to the front door of the Capitol and chat to the security guard. I'm not joking. It was amazing. It's one of those famous buildings in the world. And I would be able to walk up all those steps and talk to him. Of course, you can't get within a quarter of a mile of it now. So you're very right to ask, how on earth did they ever get into the grounds of the Capitol, let alone get into the building? It's outrageous.
Well, I hear you saying that they opened the gates and they allowed them in. But how did they get into the building itself? Well, imagine trying to get into the Houses of Parliament.
Yes, I know. No, I, you're totally right. I mean, that you saw smashed windows and all that. You saw people inside drawing guns, pointing them at windows and telling people to stop and don't come back.
They've said bombs have been carried in. But yeah. Why haven't they named this poor woman who was shot dead?
I don't know. They haven't even given the details of the other three people who've died due to, quote, medical circumstances, whatever that means, you know. It's all a bit of a mystery. But what a terrible, terrible legacy to have been left behind by the outgoing president. Shocking, shocking thing to have happened. And, you know, in the past, I've had some sympathies for Donald Trump. I thought that he sorted out the North Korea problem. I thought that he got the economy going. I felt that it was all very, you know, political in the antagonism and the opposition to him. But really, that you just can't find any forgiveness whatsoever in the way he deliberately programmed the last days of his presidency.
Yeah, somebody said yesterday on Facebook that it reminds them of 1933 in Germany.
Yes.
And that was very sinister. They're saying that, you know, the dictator he most reminds us of now is Mussolini, with his form of ultra-nationalism. It's very dangerous.
Yeah, no,
the question I'm asking is, you've got all sorts of police and army brought out against the Black Lives Matter marches. Yes. Do you remember?
Yes.
They were ready and waiting.
Yes.
So why was so little preparation made for Trump's crowd and their demonstration?
The question has been asked. Had that been a black crowd, would shots have been fired before they even got to the door of the Capitol, you know? And that, I think, is really a microcosm of the huge problem America's got for itself now and going forward, what it's got to deal with. But the thing is, you're right to ask the question. Those people who stormed in there, they're not just an overnight passing fancy. They're going to become some kind of rebel army. You know what I mean? And they're going to become a rebel army and develop a movement called Trumpism, which looks like a very dangerous thing to me.
So that makes him basically Adolf Hitler.
Well, hopefully not. I'd hate to go down that street. I think America's democratic system is far too sophisticated to allow that sort of thing to happen. But nevertheless, it is a hugely worrying development in a country that you and I have visited so many times. And one of the reasons we love it there is because we've always felt we're in the freest country in the world. Yeah.
And don't think it couldn't happen in the UK.
Well, look, you know.
Look how many people believe all the stuff about Brexit and still voted for it.
Well, listen, let's not tempt fate, OK? Democracy was never breached in anything that we've had here. And we've had a few.
Not yet.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Don't tempt fate, you know. Fortunately, the democratic system in this country is probably even more sophisticated than America's because it's been around longer. So let's just hope we get through it. Ms. Jones, have you ever worried about people regarding you as being average?
Absolutely not. Because there's no such thing as average, is there, really? If you think about it, it's like numbers. Mm-hmm. Add them all up and divide them by the number of numbers, and that's what you get, which isn't actually average at all.
Yeah.
So you take for example, the average of 10 and 20 is 15, okay, which is, it's neither like 10 nor like 20.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's any such thing as average. We're all completely unique. And so, no, I don't ever worry about that at all.
Yeah. Well, I find that very, worrying, really, because one of the things I've always worried about in life is being described as average. I have never, ever wanted to be average. I've always wanted to be way above average. I wanted to be special. I've wanted to be outstanding. I wanted to be so far away from average that average couldn't even touch me. And the reason I'm telling you all this is because a lady called Eleanor Ross has written a book called Good Enough: The Myth of Success and How to Celebrate the Joy in Being Average. Oh, I'm putting my fingers down my throat, Leslie Ann. I can't bear it.
Well, first of all, she has an average name, Eleanor Ross. And second of all, the title of her book, Good Enough. So what, you know, please. Yeah. I think we all need a bit of a thrill now, don't we? We don't need to be told that it's okay to be okay. We need to be the best that we can be.
Yeah.
No, not interested in this one at all.
Yeah, but the point is, if you just go through life settling for being average, where's the ambition? Where's the desire? Where's the intent and the will to do something with your life? You know, if we all woke up every morning saying, oh, I'm going to be happy to be average today, we'd all end up as bus drivers. There's nothing wrong with bus drivers, obviously. We'd all end up, you know, as street sweepers. Nothing wrong with street sweepers. We'd all end up being clerks in at the electricity board filling in forms, because that's what average is.
I think a lot of people wouldn't have the courage to try and not be average. It's that thing our parents used to say about knowing your place in life, wasn't it? And not getting ideas. Yeah, not getting ideas above your station. That used to be the phrase, didn't it? But I'm like you. I've always wanted to get above my station.
Yes, exactly.
I've always wanted that little bit extra.
Yes.
So I guess that's why we do what we do and other people don't.
Of course. I totally agree with you. So in the end, I've turned the argument round and you've admitted you don't want to be average, haven't you?
No, I don't want to be average at all, but I think there's no such thing as average.
Okay. Now then, Ms. Jones, you spent most of your life interviewing and writing about pop stars, rock stars and all that. Now, this is long, long before your time, but I came across a tribute to a chap who's just died called Jeff Stevens, songwriter who turned out hit after hit, including There's a Kind of Hush All Over the World, and Tell Me When, and The Crying Game. I know all there is to know about The Crying Game.
Great song. A funny thing about that song is loads of people think that Boy George wrote it because he recorded it.
That's
it's
right.
Only a cover. There was a guy, a bit before my time really, but there's loads of footage of him on the internet. Guy called Dave Berry, dangle the microphone down the back of his shirt.
Oh, I remember that,
he used to push his hand over, you know, like when you sort of rub the back of your neck, like somebody's caressing you and pretending he was dancing with a woman, I suppose.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, he did The Crying Game.
Right, okay. Well, the amazing thing about this bloke is that we all know, you know, it's one of those pub question things, that Paul McCartney and John Lennon don't write or read music, you know, which is astonishing, really. But it's like saying George Orwell couldn't speak or write English, if you see what I mean. Except, of course, it's very different in music. But at least they could sit down at a piano keyboard or pick up a guitar or something else and actually, you know, give the tune that's in their head a physical form, play it on a piano or play it on a guitar. This guy, Jeff Stevens, he couldn't even play any musical instruments, couldn't write or read music. He just used to get ideas in his head, go around humming them until he met somebody who could actually play a guitar or something and said, here, I'll turn this into a musical song. I mean, that's astonishing, don't you?
Yeah, I think it's very common. There is a theory that being able to notate is a hindrance to creativity, which is interesting, isn't it? Because if it's too... Yeah. Well, if it's too mathematical and regimented and there's a structure to it, it might confine your ability to create the stuff in the first place.
Right. OK, well, that's a very complicated sort of artistical view of life. But you know more about these things than I do. But I do like the stories behind some of his great records. I mean, the ones he's written are just amazing. Semi-detached suburban Mr. James. Do you remember that? Is the semi-detached suburban Mr. James. That was Manfred Mann, right? These are all before your time, of course.
Yeah,
this show.
They are.
But the one I really like is he wrote You Won't Find Another Fool Like Me, which goes, you won't find another fool like me, babe. Do you remember? It's the New Seekers.
And that's a good song, actually.
Great song. Went to number one.
For its time, yes. I mean, it must have been during the 70s,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, that's right. But anyway, when I...
Lynn Paul, do you remember her? She was very beautiful.
I do. She was the blonde lead singer of the New Seekers. Yes, I do.
And she was a shagger. She had Peter Sellers and all kinds of people.
What? Yeah. Good God, Miss Jones, do we really need to know that? We're talking about musical talent. You can still bring in a bit of the old horizontal refreshment history of people we're talking about. I don't know. But anyway, the point is, he goes into his office one day and he's got a new assistant who is Swedish, and she's not looking very happy. And he said, what's wrong with you? And she said, my boyfriend's dumped me. And he said, oh, dear, well, never mind. And she said, he won't find another fool like me, you know.
Well, yeah.
And then he rushed out of his office, went, you know, down Tin Pan Alley, worked in Denmark Street, and found a bloke with a guitar and turned it into a song. Isn't that amazing?
I think most songs, if you think about the kind of the phrase, the catch, the point of the song.
Yes.
Most of them are things that we say in our daily lives.
Yes, I agree. Well, I mean, some of the Beatles songs, 8 days a week, Hard Day Night.
That was a Ringoism, wasn't it?
I was going to say they're both Ringoisms, weren't they? You know, No, I totally agree. But I just marvel at people's genius, you know. When they turn these things. Oh, the other one he did, which caught my eye, was Mary Hopkins, who was introduced to the world, of course, on Apple Records by the Beatles. Her second great hit. Her first one was...
Those Were the Days.
Those Were the Days. Thank you very much indeed. But her second one was Knock Knock Who's There? And that was written for the Eurovision Song Contest. And she finished second, narrowly, to a young 19-year-old Irish girl called Dana, who sang all kinds of everything. All kinds of everything reminds me of you.
I don't think it was Ian Paisley who sang that.
Well, no, but it did sound like that, believe me. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky, myself and Miss Jones. Miss Jones, at this stage of the new year, what is the sort of totalling up on the book situation with your great book, Who Killed John Lennon?
What do you mean, totalling up?
Well, I mean, I suppose sales start to sort of drop off now, don't they, in the new year? Because the whole idea is to get them sold at the end of last year for Christmas and all that. So what happens now?
Ah, well, there are still a number of foreign publications yet to come. France isn't out, for example. I think we've still got about 9 editions to come. And then the paperback. The British...
paperback writer.
Yeah, well, that'll be me in May because the paperback version comes then. Yeah. And I'm almost on the verge of delivering my new book, which my deadline is the 18th of January. So, all hands on deck for that one
indeed,
at the moment.
Indeed.
I'm getting there.
Great. Okay. Well, anyway, look, I talked to you a bit earlier in this podcast about going to the radio station. So all things being... as they are, I shall be recording again on Talk Radio on Saturday between 5 and 7 and Sunday between 1 and 4, although some of those hours may be variable in the weeks afterwards, but I will keep our audience notified, obviously. Tell me, have you ever been or are you a big fan of Mr. Rowan Atkinson?
No, can't stand the man. Yeah, I'm sorry. I shared a train journey with him in July 2019. We were going up, I've talked to you about this before, we were going up to the graduation day of Liverpool Institute.
I didn't know he was on the train with you that day. Yeah,
yeah, he was getting made a fellow or a you know, something of the Institute. And we all went up on the train together and it was a great party. I think I said to you, Wayne Sleep, you know, the dancer, he was there, dancing up and down the aisles with the ticket collectors. And
Were you in first class, I hope?
Yes.
Yes,
yeah,
good.
We were.
Good.
And we had great fun, except for Rowan Atkinson.
Right.
You know when you first get on the train and you turn to the left and just inside those swishy sliding doors that you get, there's a single seat by the luggage stack thing
Yes.
So there's just one seat by itself where you can sit.
Yeah.
So in this lovely first-class carriage where we're going to be served lunch and all the rest of it, there's this tiny little seat squashed in behind where the suitcases go.
Yeah.
And that is the seat Rowan Atkinson chooses so that he doesn't have to socialise with the rest of us.
God. Really?
Well, yeah.
So did you attend?
I went up to say hello, because we're all in it together. You know, we're all there for the same reason. So I went over and introduced myself.
Yeah.
And he looked at me as though I were something smeared on the bottom of his shoe.
Terrible.
And he's very dour, no humour at all, which is very disappointing.
Well, considering he's a comedian.
And created one of the great comedic characters of, you know, all time, so they say.
Yeah.
But a very unappealing chap, I thought. He didn't join in. He didn't come down to dinner. He didn't... For breakfast the next morning, we all sat together. We're still having a laugh. It's like being
Which hotel did you stay in? Can you remember?
Oh, the nice one opposite the
Marriott or the Crown Philharmonic Plaza Hall.
No. It's a very stylish place. The Hope Street Hotel.
Oh, Hope Street. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Got it. Yeah. Yeah.
Really, really nice. Opposite the Philharmonic.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Concert hall there.
Yes.
And we had a lovely time. It was like being at boarding school.
Yeah.
Everyone having breakfast together, throwing rolls, having a laugh. He was sitting in a table by himself all the way over at the window, and didn't go up to the serve yourself cornflakes bit, you know, all of that. Had the waitress bring him everything to his table so that he didn't have to get up across the room and come and say hi to us.
What was his interaction with Paul McCartney like?
Didn't really have any, didn't see it.
Well, what was he there for?
To accept his award. But I just thought, you know, Rowan, if you can't do it for real, just pretend.
Yeah. And do you know what I'd have done if I was going to be that isolationist? I'd have, because he's worth about 65 million quid, apparently, I'd have just got a Bentley, I'd have got in the back and I got the driver to take me there. And if I wanted to be on my own, I'd have been on my own, but not to the extent where he's actually being crass and rude to everybody else by ignoring them, which I think is horrible.
I know. And it's a very social occasion.
Yeah.
And all the students are there to see all these celebrities. You know, it's all part of the graduation process. It was a very exuberant day when Paul McCartney walked into the hall at their school for the ceremony. I can't explain how exciting this was. Everyone was jumping up out of their seats, throwing their hats in the air, screaming and shouting. It was like being at a gig because Sir Paul McCartney had just walked in.
Right.
It was so thrilling. And Mike Batt was there, who's a friend of mine. We were all jumping up and down as well. And there's Rowan Atkinson sitting there, po-faced. And you think, give us a break, you know, just rise to the occasion and just bring something to this rather than just take something from this.
Sure. I mean, each to his own. I mean, I think he's been great and everything I've seen him in, you know, not the 9 o'clock news started, but then Blackadder, I thought was just brilliant. Mr. Bean, I can take Mr. Bean in about 20 minute slots, but after that, it starts to wear on me a bit. But also, I like these films which were heavily criticised, Johnny English. You know, the bungling sort of secret agent. But funny enough, the only time I ever met him, it's a little bit similar to your experience. When I first went into radio, the radio station I was working for was based in Oxford Street. And so you got up into town, into Oxford Street, and I used to have to get in there very early in the morning, 5:30. And on three occasions in a fortnight, I got into the lift at 5:30 to be joined by Rowan Atkinson, whose agent was on a floor above the radio station.
Oh, I know his agent. It's a guy called Alex Armitage.
Ah, that's him. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I know him. There's a very famous story about that because Alex has a pronounced stutter.
Yes, that's right.
And the story is he was on the phone negotiating a gig for Rowan and they were discussing the fee and Alex was saying, it's £500.
Yeah, right. But on those three occasions when I tried to say hello, I didn't get a change of expression on his face. You know what I mean? It was.
So he just didn't speak to you.
Just didn't. Well, it was as if I wasn't in the lift with him, if you see what I mean.
That is a very complicated brain, isn't it? A strange mind who can create humour to make everybody else fall about laughing, but to have no humour in one's own heart. I think that's very odd.
Yeah. Anyway, the reason we're talking about this is because he's made a bit of a pronouncement lately about cancel culture being a bad thing. Yeah, well, we all know that, you know, and I'm glad that he's started talking about that. Lawrence Fox has talked about it. But the main part of the story, so I suppose, and I saw the story in a heavy paper, I think I saw it in the Times, but my tabloid genes suddenly erupted here when I saw in the last book one paragraph of this story, he's never going to do Mr. Bean again. He's retired Mr. Bean, which I thought was a much better story because when these guys retire their characters, it's quite significant, isn't it?
We can do without Mr. Bean, can't we?
Well, I suppose so. I think it's a monetary thing. I think Mr. Bean makes more money in the version that's a cartoon one, and he puts his voice in that. But anyway, what do I know about these things? Now then, Miss Jones, do you know a lady called Bryony Gordon?
Yeah, she's a journalist. She's the daughter of a friend of mine,
Jane Gordon.
Jane Gordon, who I used to work with on You magazine.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I wrote a piece the other day from Bryony, who I've been following for years because I think she's rather eccentric. But I didn't realise how many problems she's had in her life, in her job, trying to get herself together, and now finally sort of coming to terms with who she is and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's quite a common problem amongst writers, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, with Bryony, all her books are about something that has gone wrong in her life and how she got out of it. She was very fat at one point, which she would admit herself, and she wrote a book about how she got thin. I think this is kind of standard fodder, isn't it? She's a nice girl. Yeah. She writes well. She's
sure. And also, funny enough,
mom, but yeah.
Yeah, funny enough, we talked about the lady earlier about, you know, being average and all that. The main punchline on this one is Bryony Gordon saying, whisper it, but there's no such thing as normal. And again, I think we all kind of knew that, didn't we? Talking about ladies that you know and ladies of distinction, it won't have surprised you to have seen a piece just a couple of days ago from David Bowie's widow, Iman, is it? Or
Iman, yes.
Iman, saying that that's it. I'm not looking for another boyfriend again. Nobody can ever replace David. That's quite a nice touching tribute, isn't it?
Well, it's fairly obvious, isn't it? How could any bloke ever, anywhere in the world, live up to David Bowie?
Well, I suppose that's...
The other thing is, she's 65 years old. You know, you kind of get to the stage when it's all a bit tedious, isn't it? You can happily live by yourself, especially with her money. She lives in the country now, upstate New York. Why would you want to entangle some new bloke into all that?
Yeah, but she doesn't look 65. That's the point. She looks to me
Nobody does anymore. Well, nobody looks 65.
But she looks about 50 and she's still very glamorous. Surely she's not going to spend the rest of her life locked away in a log cabin in upper New York State, is she?
What are you saying? A woman is nothing without a man.
No, I'm saying that she deserves to get out in the world and circulate and mix with men and women.
She does. She does. She has a very active social life. She's very happy with the way her life is. She's got a beautiful daughter, Alexandria, and she's got a stepson who is Duncan, film director. And she's busy. She does a lot of charity stuff. She's managing David's estate.
Yeah.
I don't think she needs a bloke. No, sorry. I don't think I'd need one in her position. I don't need one now.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm very glad to hear all that, you independent women who must go on. Now, what I was going to say to you was that I am delighted to have seen a report about some absolute disgraceful behaviour in a Fleet Street newsroom. It's only filtering out now, but it happened before Christmas. I don't want to mention the title because, of course, we have friends the length and breadth of Fleet Street. We don't want to put them in a difficult position. But
it's been published. It was in private eye.
Well, yes, I know. But, you know, well, you're absolutely right. But I mean, I really loved it. It was a really old fashioned account of people getting together a couple of days before Christmas, loads of drink being taken into the newsroom, people getting absolutely bladderated, and then loads of descriptions of very bad behaviour happening between members of staff of the opposite sex, not just in that particular newsroom, but in bathrooms all over the building. I mean, Miss Jones, I thought that era had gone when you and I left Fleet Street. Not that you and I ever, got into that sort of thing together, obviously.
Do you know, in my day, the most outrageous thing you did was photocopy your bum at the Christmas party.
Disgraceful, honestly.
I mean, is that really disgraceful compared with all the shagging and sex and drugs and rock and roll that seems to have gone on at this?
Look, you say that was the most disgraceful thing, but it wasn't, was it? There was much more riotous behaviour going on with drink and certainly, you know, inter-office relationships. I mean, blimey, you'd walk into an office and find a couple spread-eagled on the desk, wouldn't you? And you'd say nothing.
I never saw such a thing.
Oh, I did, yeah. Oh, yeah, I saw that.
You actually saw people at it on a desk?
Definitely, yeah, more than once. Used to have leaving dues and all that kind of stuff, and everybody would then pile back to the office and get down and get with it with each other. Yeah, it used to go on all the time. You've had a very sheltered Fleet Street life, Miss Jones, if you're not aware of.
I suppose they protected me of that kind of thing in those days.
I should hope so. But anyway, just to get sort of real about this, the point is that Kay Burley, who's also within our profession, the profession of the media, broadcasting, she's now enduring a 6-month ban for breaking COVID rules. And, you know, I'm not trying to get anybody into trouble, but it seems to me like there must have been a bit of a break of COVID rules there. And, you know, I don't want anybody disciplined or anything. I think COVID rules are often too tough and unable to fulfil.
Oh, stop hedging about the place, Mike.
No,
was no social distancing going on between all these shaggers.
That's true. You can't get social distancing if you're involved in copulation.
COVID rules, because there were more than however many there are supposed to be this week of them, all in one place. They weren't socially distancing. They were interacting extremely personally, and they were putting other people's lives at risk. So, I think slapped wrist for all of them. And, you know, we probably should expose who they were. It's all right to have rules for Kay Burley and rules for everybody else.
Yes, well, you know, it's okay. I suppose what you're saying is right. I just don't like to veer on the side of pointing the finger at people, having committed so many sins myself over the years. Did you, during the course of your fantastic career, which of course is not anyway over, but I meant your newspaper reporting career, did you ever meet and talk to Aled Jones?
Oh, yes. Yes, I love Aled Jones, fellow Welshman.
Flying through the air. Da, 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 da. I love that at Christmas, you know. Well, and a normal Christmas. I couldn't watch it this Christmas because I thought Christmas is really rather cancelled. But that's a beautiful cartoon and a beautiful song, isn't it?
It really is. And it's interesting that everybody seems to think that Aled was the singer, the treble, the beautiful choir boy who performed on that original film in 1982 for Channel 4.
Yes.
It wasn't actually him.
Right.
It was a young guy called Peter Orty, who was a St. Paul's Cathedral choir boy. But his voice broke before they were able to release the single, the music.
Right.
And so Aled, who was a chorister at Bangor Cathedral from the age of 9, he was brought in to cover it.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay.
So Aled did the single that was released that everybody bought.
Yes, I see.
But Peter Orty sang it on the film.
Did he?
Yeah.
What, on the cartoon, The Snowman?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realise that. Oh,
yeah, everybody gets it wrong. But the other thing is, people seem to think that Aled Jones retired from singing in about 1987, but he didn't.
That's what I looked it up.
He's had a very full career.
Right.
His voice broke when he was 16, but by that time, imagine this, by the age of 16, he'd recorded 16 million albums. He'd sold more than 6 million copies.
Yeah.
He'd sung for Pope John Paul II, the Queen, Charles and Di.
Yeah.
He sang at Bob Geldof and Paula Yates' wedding.
Wow.
He went to the Royal Academy of Music and then the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School.
Yes.
And ever since then, he's had a very long adult recording career. And a lot of his repertoire is religious and inspirational music, of course. And he presents songs of praise quite often, doesn't he?
Yes.
He played the lead in Joseph. He's done a lot of touring productions. He did his first baritone album with Universal Music. He's been broadcasting for Classic FM all these years.
Yes.
He certainly hasn't gone anywhere.
Mm. Well, the reason I mention is he's 50 now, and you can't really figure out that Jones is 50 because, of course, he was a choir boy, wasn't he? But no, you're right. I met him once, and I'll tell you where it was. I got invited to a first night in the West End. It was a production, you won't be surprised to know, by Mr. Bill Kenwright, the world's biggest theatre entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm. Your best mate.
Yes, and a good friend, chairman of Everton Football Club. And Bill always throws a fantastic party afterwards. And that night, it was at the hotel opposite the BBC in Portland Place. You know the one I'm talking about?
The Langham?
Yes, that's it, Langham. Yeah, well done, yeah. And and I was sitting at the table next to Aled Jones, and he was very personable, and I chatted to him, and I was doing sports radio then, Talk Sport. He had an interest in football. I think he's an Arsenal fan. And I said, well, you must come on the radio station. And I never heard from him again. We put in several requests, and, you know, I thought it was all on and all that, but I never heard from him. I don't hold that against him. I mean, the thing is, in that sort of environment, in an after-show party, you don't want to start having a discussion with somebody about something you don't want to do you?
Well, not really. And he probably put it on to his agent, and his agent said, well, you've got nothing to promote at the moment, so what's the point? You know, it's usually that, isn't it?
No, I totally agree. But anyway, he was, you know, very pleasant that night. He wasn't trying to be big-headed or anything like that. So I thought, well, you know, that's just one of those things.
He's a lovely guy. I have a lot of time for Aled Jones.
Yeah, that's great. Now then, just finally, Miss Joan, we talked a little bit about Fleet Street and the excesses. I noticed that it's the birthday, age 69, of Lord Beaverbrook, okay? Mm-hmm. And, of course, you think Lord Beaverbrook, and immediately, if you're of my generation, and again, I think you're a bit too young for this, you think of the Lord Beaverbrook, who founded the Daily Express, the modern Daily Express, before the last war, and who was such a dynamic businessman. He came from Canada, dynamic businessman, that Winston Churchill made him head of aircraft production in the Second World War. And without him, we wouldn't have won the war, because Beaverbrook took took it upon himself to produce enough Spitfires to win the Battle of Britain, which is what I think we should now be doing, by the way, with the rollout of the vaccine. Go and find a mega industrialist in this country, Lord Sugar or Richard Branson or somebody who knows how to make things work, and get them to roll out the vaccine. That's what I think.
Or Amazon or something like that.
Yeah, Amazon. You know, sure. Jeff Bezos. Why not? Yeah, I agree.
He gets things done.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree with you. Why are we dithering? Yes. We should have vaccinated millions of people by now.
No, I totally agree. I'm going to try and get Tim Martin, who runs Wetherspoons, to put himself forward as the vaccines are, and use all his pubs, which are all closed down now, as vaccine centres, where people can come and get vaccinated in the front door, out the back, get it very quickly. But anyway, back to Lord Beaverbrook. It's amazing. It's his grandson who's now Lord Beaverbrook, because in between the first Lord Beaverbrook, there's a guy called Max Aitken, who you may have remembered. He took over the running of the Express when his father died. The Express fell into disrepair and is a shadow of its former self now. Do you know what the circulation of the Daily Express is today?
Oh, it's got to be less than 100,000.
No, it's not that low, but it's about 300,000.
Oh, is it? Okay.
You're absolutely right. And when I worked for it at its when I first got there in 81, it was selling 2 million a day. So it's down to 300,000.
2 million, because the Sun was about 3 million, wasn't it?
The Sun at its peak was 4. The Mirror at its peak in the 60s was 4 million. They're all now down to like 350,000, something like that.
Mm. The Mail's doing very well still.
The Mail's still doing well, but I mean, not the figures it had, you know, in the 80s.
No, because they're not newspapers anymore. They follow the news. They don't break the news now.
Yeah.
We're not waiting for a newspaper to drop through our letterbox so we can find out what's going on in the world. Because all we've got to do is put the telly on or listen to the radio or the internet. We can be sitting there in our bed with the internet all night long. So they are not newspapers now, and that's why circulations are falling. Also, the advertising revenue has dropped off that.
You know, you're absolutely right. But Beaverbrook built the Black Lubyanka in Fleet Street, that incredible iconic building, which I was so proud to work in. I mean, the feeling you got when you walked in there in the morning thinking, I am the news editor of the Daily Express and I'm walking into the most famous newspaper building in the world, built by Lord Beaverbrook. It was an amazing thing. You know, the power and the glory of papers in those days. And I was lucky enough, by the way, because I got in pretty early, you know, like you. There were people there old enough to be able to tell me stories about running the paper with Lord Beaverbrook. And if you think about that now in terms of newspaper history, and I'd sit in bars and these guys aged about 60 then or 62 would tell about their, you know, their meeting with the great Lord Beaverbrook and how the man ran the paper and how he would shoot off to Downing Street to see Churchill and all this kind of stuff. It's amazing, honestly. So
those were the days,
those were the days, so there we go, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. All I can say to all our millions of listeners and to yourself, Miss Jones, is that the world is getting more and more dangerous every day. Please, everybody, look after yourself, so you're going to be around for a long time yet to listen to the next episodes of Life on Planet Porky.
It's what we're here for.
You won't find another fool like me, babe. Do you remember? It's the New Seekers.
And it that's a good song, actually.
Great song. Went to number one.
For its time, yes. I mean, it was must have been during the 70s,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, that's right. But anyway, when
I... Lynn Paul, do you remember her? She was very beautiful.
I do. She was the blonde lead singer of the New Seekers. Yes, I do.
And she was a shagger. She had Peter Sellers and all kinds of people.
What? Good God, Miss Jones. Do we really need to know that? We're talking about musical talent. You can still bring in a bit of the old horizontal refreshment history of people we're talking about. I don't know.
Do you know, in my day, the most outrageous thing you did was photocopy your bum at the Christmas party.
Disgraceful, honestly. You
know, yeah. I mean, is that really disgraceful compared with all the shagging and sex and drugs and rock and roll that seems to have gone on at this?
Well, look, you say that was the most disgraceful thing, but it wasn't, was it? There was much more riotous behaviour going on with drink and certainly, you know, inter-office relationships. I mean, blimey, you'd walk into an office and find a couple spread-eagled on the desk, wouldn't you? And you'd say nothing.
I never saw such a thing.
Oh, I did, yeah. Oh, yeah, I saw that.
You actually saw people at it on a desk?
Definitely, yeah, more than once. You know, if we all woke up every morning saying, oh, I'm going to be happy to be average today, we'd all end up as bus drivers. There's nothing wrong with bus drivers, obviously.